The last case for argument, United States v. Albiola, Mr. Thies.
Good morning. May it please the court. The defendant, Monico Albiola, was charged with and convicted of a very serious crime for which he received a lengthy sentence. And the issues before the jury and before the district court were basically limited to his knowledge as to what was in a package which he clearly received and signed for when it arrived at his home in Schaumburg, Illinois. I would respectfully disagree with the government's assessment and with the district court's assessment in its post-trial order on the post-trial motion that the evidence was in any way overwhelming or unduly or particularly strong, because on the issue of knowledge, there was no direct evidence of his knowledge. For that reason, the evidence with regard to what he knew should have been limited to the transaction that and the evidence concerning the transaction that resulted in his conviction. What happened, and it wasn't even clear, I think, as to the basis for the court's admission of these other mailing labels from the car and from the U.S. Postal Service. The court originally stated that in the colloquy in the motion in limine prior to the trial, the government first argued that it wasn't 404B, that in fact it was inextricably intertwined with the offense. The district court interjected in the colloquy that he believed it was possibly that it was evidence of one of the elements of the offense, but didn't rule on the motion. At the time of that the government introduced the evidence, the court recognized that this was the subject of the motion in limine and asked if that was the case. When he was told it was, he merely allowed the evidence in. What distinguishes this from either 404B or a case where it's inextricably intertwined is that there's no real evidence that these other mailing labels were in any way related to any illegal activity. There is no evidence whatsoever that they were other drug transactions. And I think what it was clear was that the government was trying to suggest to the jury that the defendant must have been involved with other drug transactions because, look, he had other mailing labels in his car. There were other mailing labels that were involved with transit or mailings from Arizona. It was an improper, it certainly was improper as 404B evidence. It isn't evidence of any other offense. There's no evidence that it is. And this court has repeatedly made it clear that 404B evidence should never be, that the whole idea behind it is that it's a rule of exclusion.
What about their modus operandi argument that these other mailing labels also had, or they were also express mail and they also had fictitious addresses on them? Why isn't that admissible as modus operandi evidence?
Well, two things. One is that it's use of the express mail. It's the government argued, in fact, along those lines, excuse me, that this just shows that it's some evidence that he knew how to use express mail.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that the combination, the express mail and the fictitious addresses, suggests a practice of, this is the way he operates. And that's permissible. This is a distinctive method of operation.
Well, if there was some evidence that these were other offenses, other illegal...
Why does he have fictitious addresses on them?
Well, there was some evidence that that the addresses either didn't exist or that the name on them...
So what's the purpose of that?
Well, there was no evidence that the defendant was in any way responsible for those other than they were found. Two of them were found in his car. They would have to have some nexus.
That doesn't go to admissibility. Let me ask you about the other point, the one about the investigation. I don't understand your hearsay argument at all.
If I may, the way they asked it is they did not call the defendant's parents as witnesses in this case. Instead, they tried to get the evidence that the parents didn't know a David Albiola, which is the name on there, by getting it in through the agent who interviewed them.
No, that's not it. The agent is just testifying to what he was told. He's not vouching for the truth of what they said.
Well, he is.
That's not. You can always testify to what someone tells you. What you can't do if the other person isn't available, you can't say, the person told me that, and by the way, it's true. He didn't say that.
Well, I think the clear implication...
Look, I do an investigation. I try to find out if this person exists. Nobody says he exists, so I conclude it didn't exist. There's no hearsay there.
You
said to him, well, do you know that these people told you the truth when they said there was no David Albiola? He said, no, of course, I didn't know. I didn't check up on them. I'm just reporting on my investigation. I asked everybody I could. Nobody seemed to have heard of this guy. He's testifying to his personal knowledge, what he did. He's not testifying to the truth of what people told him.
I would respectfully disagree, because if the court were correct in that interpretation of the hearsay rule, they wouldn't have to call live witnesses at all. They could just call an agent to go out and testify as to, oh, I talked to this person, and he said this about that the defendant did. I talked to this person, and he said it would undermine the entire purpose for...
No, that would, but of course, if you're looking for someone who you don't know whether the person exists or not, you're going to have to ask questions and form a judgment on the basis of the answers. How else would you prove something like that?
And actually, you've suggested another reason why the hearsay rule exists and why this was improper. Because, for example, if they had called the parents as a witness, the lawyer, I was the lawyer who represented Mr. Albiola at the trial, could have asked the parents, well, is it a large family? Are there a number of relatives? Do you know the names of all the cousins and aunts and uncles? I didn't get to cross-examine. That's
all
the whole idea.
All you had to do was ask the investigator, do you know whether these people you talked to were telling you the truth or not? And you'd have to say, no, I don't know that.
I think that question would be objectionable, because I don't think that agent could give an opinion as to whether the people were telling the truth.
Right, he couldn't. That's the whole point. He couldn't. Or you can ask the judge. The judge would say, look, all the agent can testify to is that these people told him this. He can't testify that what they said was true.
Well,
doesn't that take care of any hearsay problem?
I would say it does not, Your Honor, but I understand.
Says, you can't. This witness is not competent to testify about whether what anybody said to him was true. All he can say is, this is what they said. This is what I heard. You can always testify to what you heard, because you have as much personal knowledge of what you heard as the person who spoke to you.
I disagree. The family would have knowledge about the substance of the information.
All this investigator knows is what someone said to him.
Right.
And the judge can tell the jury, he can testify to what he heard. He can't testify to the truth of what the person told him. That would be forbidden hearsay.
And again, I would just suggest that the substance of it, in fact, the court, as you may recall from the record, there was a second question relating to that, which was actually the objection was sustained when it was objected that he couldn't testify about the substance of what the parents had told him. The first time they did allow, the court did allow the statement in, because I think all out-of-court statements, the whole idea is that they can be challenged as to whether they're truthful or not if the witness is there to cross-examine them. We didn't have that opportunity. And if the court has any other questions, my time is up, but I'll be glad to address
okay.
them.
Thank you, Mr. Thies. Mr. Dice?
Tice, yes. Thank you, God.
Nice. Sorry.
May it please the court. The district court properly admitted evidence of the prior mailings for several reasons. Judge Posner, as you mentioned, modus operandi, absence of mistake, and also showing plan and preparation on the part of the defendant. The prior mailings were all express parcels. They all involved fictitious return addresses, just like the subject parcel, and they all were tied to the defendant in some way, either because the address, the false address, was in some way associated with him, or the name on the package was some way associated with him. An appropriate 404B limiting instruction was given, and for all those reasons, the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting evidence of the prior mailings. As for the hearsay objection, Judge Posner, again, as you alluded to, there was no hearsay here. It's not correct. The record would show that the questions that were asked simply asked the postal inspector to describe his investigation and what his conclusions were based on that investigation. There was no out-of-court statement was elicited during that testimony. And so for that reason, Rule 801 was not implicated here. And again, the district court did not abuse its discretion in overruling the defense objection. And then the final point is, even if the district court erred on either one of those points, the error would be harmless in light of the substantial evidence of the defendant's guilt here. And that argument is sufficiently developed in the briefs and will rest on the briefs for purposes of the harmless error argument. Unless there's questions from the panel, we would simply ask that the court affirm the convictions of the defendant.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Theis. Mr. Theis, do you have anything further?
No, Your Honor, unless the court has any questions.
And you were appointed.
I was.
So we thank you for your efforts.
Thank you very much.
And the court will stand in recess.